Good morning. I'm going to speak in English because I don't know Danish. So I'm going to try to speak slow. It is such an honor to be here and to have the chance to share with you. My name is Josh Brom. I'm the president of Equal Rights Institute, which is a pro-life organization based in North Carolina. And it was just so cool this morning to think about how we have so much in common, even though I don't understand your language. The children's storybook Bible that was given to Noah's parents is the exact same children's Bible that we read with our kids. So we've read it through so many times now. And I love it because even in the Old Testament stories, it's always pointing back to Jesus. So even if you're an adult, you should really read the storybook Bible. You might find some really important things in there. I was in the Denver airport several years ago. And I had about 45-minute layover between my flights. I was on my way home. And so I grabbed a sandwich, and I sat at my gate to eat. And I sat across from a businesswoman in her late 30s who asked me the question that I've spent my entire career hating. She said, "What do you do for a living?" Because I have a weird job, you know? And it's like, if she's pro-choice, I want to be able to have a good conversation with her, and how can I answer that opening question in a way that's going to get things started off okay, with her not, like, angry at me right from the start? And so I've always tried different things, and it's never felt like anything worked. And so I tried something new that day in how I answered that question, and now it's become basically the only thing I tell people when they ask me that question. So she said, "What do you do for a living?" And I said, "I help pro-lifers to be less weird." And she kind of smiled a little bit, and she said, "What does that mean?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying to help pro-life people to use more good arguments and fewer bad ones. But maybe more importantly, I want to help the pro-life community to connect relationally with people who are different from us, with people who are coming from maybe a different political or religious background." Said a different way, I want Christians to live out Colossians 4, 5 through 6. Which says, "Conduct yourselves with wisdom toward outsiders, making the most of the opportunity. Let your speech always be with grace, as though seasoned with salt, so that you will know how you should respond to each person." So the heart of my ministry that we started 4.5 years ago, that my brother and I started, is that we want to help pro-life people to become more like Jesus. What would it look like if Jesus talked to a pro-choice person? Like, and you just got to sit and watch. Like, what would that look like? What would his body language be like? What kinds of questions would he ask? What kinds of questions would he not ask? And what would it sound like when he made arguments? So we're like, we're not hiding from the truth. What would it sound like when Jesus made arguments that are grounded in truth, but spoken with gentleness and grace? I want to help pro-life people all over the world to get closer to that mark, that we would not only become smarter in the way that we make arguments, but that we also be more loving and Christ-like. So we do speaking and writing and campus outreach, and we try to help pro-life people, especially in the areas of practical dialogue tips. What are the different little things that we do to help people feel more receptive and less defensive? We also talk about philosophy. You know, there are some good arguments, there's some bad arguments. We don't want to use bad arguments, and there's some arguments that are more persuasive than others, but we also talk about relational apologetics. This is the art of being friends with pro-choice people and how you can do that and be very loving. So I want to tell you one thing that's important before I get into the meat of this message, which is that I know, and your church leadership here knows, we were talking about it this morning, that there are people here who have abortion in their past. And this might, you know, be a particularly sensitive issue for you if that's you in this congregation. And I just want you to know what the attitude is that I have and that this church leadership has, that we would want you to know. If you only hear one thing from me today, this is what you need to hear from me. And then you could tune everything else out and it would kind of be okay. You need to know that Jesus is eager and willing to forgive every sin, including the sin of abortion. I have many post-abortive friends who would go to church with a pastor who was afraid to talk about this issue because he was afraid of what it would do for people who are post-abortive. Would it cause them to go through like depression or something like that? And I think it's a very understandable concern. But I'll never forget hearing a story of a woman who had had an abortion, was in one of these churches where the pastor would talk about everything. He would talk about all issues except this one issue. And with that good intention of just not causing harm to people who are post-abortive. And she said that she knew that he meant well, but in the end she realized it actually did her harm for that. He never said it because he never used the word abortion. He would use the word adultery and pornography and all these other words, but he wouldn't ever say abortion, which caused her to feel like, oh, this must be the one unforgivable sin. It's the one thing that is so bad my pastor won't even say the word. And so I need you to know, if you have abortion in your past, the best news in the Bible is that God is so wanting you to find healing from that and to know that you are forgiven for that. It's like the prodigal son story. You should read it in the storybook Bible. It's awesome. And I would really encourage you to talk to your church leadership about that, and they can kind of guide you through that healing process. Though critics say that the Bible is silent on issues like abortion and cloning, Christians can bring moral clarity to these issues by asking three foundational questions. What does the Bible teach about human value? What does the Bible teach about the unborn? And what is the unborn? And what I'm going to do this morning is answer those three questions pretty quickly, and I'm going to spend the majority of my time exploring a final fourth question. What is our responsibility as Christians on abortion, including some practical tips for talking to pro-choice people about the issue the way that I believe that Jesus would. And I want to give credit to a couple of people for some of the things that I'm going to say. I have a mentor named Scott Klusendorf, who I've borrowed some ideas from him with his permission for the sake of this talk, and also my former pastor, Matt Troop. Did some interesting research on the biblical words for the unborn that I'm going to share with you, and that came straight from him. So let's talk about that first question. What does the Bible teach about human value? Two things. First, the Bible teaches that humans have intrinsic, transcendent value because they are made in God's image. Genesis 1, 26 through 28 says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, after our likeness.'" Now, entire sermons could be preached on exactly what does that mean. Briefly, what this passage tells me is that we reflect something about God. As a friend of mine said, we are all like broken mirrors that reflect God's essence. We're broken, and some of us may be more broken than others. But none of us are perfect mirrors because we're all fallen creatures. But we reflect something important about God. And different theologians are still discussing what is that. I think it's multiple things, but I'll briefly tell you. I think one of them is the ability to love. I think that is one of the things that we reflect about God. Some theologians think that there are other aspects of God's nature that we reflect, but for the sake of time, I'm not going to wade deeper into those waters. I'm going to assume for the sake of the rest of the sermon that you just agree with me, that there is something special about humans because God made us that way. God made us special, and that's what it says in Genesis. And the second thing that the Bible tells us about human value is not just that we're intrinsically valuable because of the kind of thing we are, but also that because humans have intrinsic value, the shedding of innocent blood is strictly forbidden. Just one example, Matthew 5:21. Jesus, while giving the Sermon on the Mount, says this, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment.'" But he went on to say, "But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment." So what does the Bible teach about the unborn? Well, we can glean something by looking at the Hebrew and Greek words that the Bible uses for the unborn. This is fascinating. And when we do, we see that the scripture teaches that the unborn are just like us, the same kind of thing we are. So if you look in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word that is used for the unborn is yeled. Y-E-L-E-D. And that's a word that generally indicates young children, but is even used occasionally to describe teenagers and young adults. So in the Old Testament, there is no word for unborn. It's just children, basically. But in the New Testament, which was originally written in Greek, the word that is used for Jesus when he's born, as a newborn, the baby Jesus, the word is brephos. And that same word is used when it describes John the Baptist leaping in his mother's womb in the presence of first trimester Jesus. So again, in the New Testament, there's no unborn versus baby. They're all babies. There's no difference. They are all humans made in God's image. And pro-choice people will sometimes say that the alleged silence in the Bible on the issue of abortion, because abortion's never mentioned, would be an argument against us. Hey, the Bible doesn't say that abortion's wrong. And that's true. There is no direct scriptural verse, thou shalt not have abortions. That is true. But that should not bother us. We can still logically infer that elective abortion is morally wrong. I actually had a pro-choice person say this to me on Facebook one time, where the best debates happen. No. This person said, don't debate on Facebook. This person said, you know, hey, if you're a Christian, show me a Bible verse that says that abortion's wrong. And I said, okay, fine. As soon as you show me a Bible verse that says that it's wrong to throw people into shark tanks. She didn't do it. It would be unreasonable to say that the Bible needs to specifically condemn every form of killing, every single kind of way that you can kill humans. Be like, you can't know it's wrong unless it says that specific. I was like, no. It says that humans are valuable, that we matter, and it's wrong to shed innocent blood. That's good enough if the unborn are valuable human beings also made in God's image. So that, hence that question, what is the unborn? And we can find that answer both scientifically and philosophically, which is what we ought to talk about if we're talking to non-Christians. I want to start not with Bible verses, because they don't believe in the Bible like I do. I want to start on common ground, on science and philosophy, and show them how reasonable the Christian worldview actually is. And then they often become interested, well, why do you believe in the Bible then? And then I can tell them, oh, I think there's this guy 2,000 years ago who walked out of his own tomb. It's pretty cool. And he gets, if that happened, and I think it did, he gets benefit of the doubt points on everything else he said. Right? Like, I can start having those conversations, but I'm starting on science and philosophy. So here's what we know from science. We know that the unborn are distinct, living, and whole human organisms. And we know that they are that from conception. We can just tell that by watching them, by observing them. Human parents can only produce human offspring. Cats have cats, dogs have dogs, humans have? Yes. There's never been a case where two humans came together and came up with a non-human. It just doesn't happen. It's not how God set it up. So that's the easy part. But philosophically, what we know is that there is no essential difference between a human embryo and you. There are differences. You're more developed. You're bigger. I just don't think that matters. But here's the way that I try to explain this to pro-choice people that has worked the best for us. We were at UC Davis a couple of years ago doing an outreach. And we had set up a pool table. It said, should abortion remain legal? And it had a yes option and a no option and an it depends option and pads of paper, just gathering people to come talk to us. And at one point, I was sitting on our table where you will usually find me at an outreach. I'm literally sitting on our table because I'm kind of a tall guy. Like, I'm not basketball player tall, but I'm tall-ish, and I'm taller than a lot of the people that I talk to. And there's this obnoxious thing that sometimes tall guys do where they'll lord their height over short women, and it's just like, ugh, just like, it's uncomfortable. And so when I sit down on our table, I'm kind of showing, like, I'm relaxed. I'm okay. I'm not freaked out. It's okay, you know? And I'm also getting myself closer to their eye line, which is, a really helpful thing. It's the closest I can get to their eye line without being weird, like getting on my knees or something like that. And so you'll usually find me at our outreach sitting on our outreach table. So here I was, and I'm talking to these three pro-choice girls. They were really angry. They were not happy that we were there. And I'm just listening to them. And at one point, to her credit, one of them asked, well, why are you here? What's your argument? And I said, I think I can explain to you in about 2 minutes why I'm pro-life. And she said, go. It's like, oh, what would you do with that 2 minutes? Here's what I did. I said, I'm a very open-minded person. I'm open-minded about almost all of my beliefs, except for my own existence and 2 + 2 = 4. Everything else falls on a spectrum of confidence for me. I've got some beliefs that I've earned, I think, a lot of confidence in by studying the smart people on both sides of the issue. I've got a lot of other beliefs I don't have very much confidence in. I haven't earned it. I haven't done the work. So I've got all these views, but one of the views that I have that I'm the most confident in, it'd be very hard for you to change my mind, is this. Is that everyone that I can see right now has an equal right to life. So we were outside at UC Davis. There's this big green area where people would play and throw frisbees, and there's a bunch of hammocks around the perimeter, which is awesome. And then there's also this lunch area, where everyone would eat lunch. There's like a cafeteria and then like outdoor tables. It was about lunchtime. You could see a couple hundred people at that point. I said, everyone that I can see right now, I think, has an equal right to life. But that's a very interesting thing because we all have a lot of differences. Right now, I can see some people who are tall and some people who are short. I see some people who are really smart. And I see some people who are trying their best. And I see some people who are good at sports and music and some people who are not. And I've seen people in wheelchairs today. Like, there's all these differences. And yet, almost everyone agrees that we have an equal right to life. How can that be? How can we explain that idea, the thing that we agree on, when there are so many differences? I think we must have something in common. And this is key. Don't miss this. It's got to be something that we all have equally. It cannot be something that you can have more or less of. It can't be like sometimes people will say, oh, yeah, humans are all valuable because we're intelligent. That's not going to do the job of explaining equality. You know why? We're not all equally intelligent. If you don't believe me, then go to YouTube today and click on the first video and read the comments. And you're going to see something. You're going to notice. Some people think better than others. And that's okay. They're human. They're equal. It's fine. Like, I'm just saying, it's got to be something that we have equally if it's going to explain equal rights. So I said, so it's got to be something that we have equally. So what is that thing? What is it that we have in common? I think it's something like humanness. It's something like being human. And if that's the thing that we have in common, and if the unborn have that, and they totally do, then the unborn get equal rights, even if that's not like what our gut instinct would be. And the last thing I said before I was out of time was, notice something about my argument. This is not a religious argument, but it's also not an emotional argument. I'm not pro-life for emotional reasons. I don't get the warm fuzzies when I look at a picture of an embryo. I don't. It looks like a fuzzy orange. It just does. I get the warm fuzzies when I look at a picture of a baby. I got the warm fuzzies watching the dedication to Noah. I got the warm fuzzies recently on Facebook. One of my friends put a picture of their newborn baby, and it's like, oh, the baby. You know, I had that human moment. I don't get that when I see a zygote. It's not doing anything for my heartstrings. I'm not pro-life for emotional reasons. I'm pro-life because it's the most rational conclusion that I can come to. Because I'm starting with equality as premise one, and I'm reasoning from there. And I have not yet heard a good pro-choice argument for discriminating against the unborn, for saying that they're out and everyone else is in. I think in the long, sad history of the human race, we've had case after case of groups of humans being called non-persons and excluded and discriminated against. It's always been bad. And I don't think we've suddenly, we're at the first time when we've taken a group of humans out of the community, out of protection, and it was the right thing to do. I think this is going to be one more case in the long, sad history of the human race treating some humans as other. That's what I said. So we know philosophically that there is no essential difference between us and the unborn. So this leads to our theological conclusion. Given what we know scientifically and philosophically, we can logically conclude that the unborn are valuable human beings who bear God's image. Therefore, elective abortion and destructive embryo research are morally wrong. So let's talk about that last question. This is where I'm going to camp for the rest of my time. What is our responsibility as Christians on abortion? A couple things. I think one of your responsibilities is to love your unborn neighbor as a fellow human being. 1 John 3:16 through 18 says something very important, which is that love is not a feeling, it's a behavior. Love is not a feeling, it's a behavior. So 1 John 3:16 through 18 says this: by this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. You should support your local Right to Life group with your time, with your money. Take advantages of some of the opportunities that they have to graciously educate people about this issue. You should also equip yourself to engage. Every single person in here in the future might have conversations with people who are pro-choice. These are very important conversations. These are people who might kill their babies in the future. You have opportunities to literally save lives if you're ready. So you should become ready. 1 Peter 3:14 through 16, one of my favorite passages says, but even if you should suffer for righteousness, let me try that again. But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled, but in your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is within you. Yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, not if, by the way, when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. You should be ready to persuasively defend a biblical worldview on abortion. There is a course that we created to help you do this, and Denmark Right to Life has open seats. If you want to get our course for free, you should talk to the Denmark Right to Life people who are out in the hall today. They have some seats for you, and if you don't join them, then you can get our course yourself. But I would want you to become equipped, and we made it because we want to be able to help people that we can't get in front of. It takes a little while to get equipped for this. But as a friend of mine once said, the more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. Become ready to have those very important conversations. Now, your pastor was very helpful in helping me prepare this sermon, and there were many things that he wanted me to talk about today. I don't have time for all of them, but I tried. But they also told me don't go over 30 minutes, so I had to choose one or the other. But I'm going to tell you a few things that were very important to him, which was basically he wanted you to get some practical help today. Just a few ideas on how you can engage with people who are pro-choice in a way that I think Jesus would. So I'm going to talk about three practical dialogue tips very quickly, and I'm also going to talk about responding to a common pro-choice argument, and then I'm going to close. Three quick practical tips. Just how do you create an atmosphere in the conversation where people feel emotionally safe? That is what you need to do if you're going to try to change their mind. People do not change their minds when they don't feel emotionally safe. So you've got to create a situation in the conversation where it doesn't feel like a debate, you know, or like you're in fight mode or something like that. You're not behind podiums. It's got to feel like you're at Starbucks having coffee with a friend. That's what the feel is should be of the conversation. So we're always thinking about what are the little things that we can do that will help people to feel receptive and not defensive. So three quick ideas. One, ask lots of clarification questions, because you don't actually know what people think, intend, or feel. The problem is sometimes we assume that we do, or worse, tell them what they think, intend, or feel. It's really obnoxious. Don't do it. Instead, ask questions. Oh, you said you're pro-choice. I don't know what that word means to you. I've heard that word used to describe lots of different views about abortion. Can you flesh that out for me? Help me understand more about what your views are. I don't care what the last person I talked to thought about abortion. What do you think about abortion? I want to understand you accurately so we don't attack a straw man where people attack a way lamer version of their argument than their actual argument, which is also very annoying. Don't do that. So you got to ask lots of clarification questions to have clarity in the conversation. Also, listen to understand them. People don't usually listen to understand. They listen to refute. A lot of times, we're just like waiting to talk. This is not really listening. And I learned that. It's not listening when you have a voice going on in your head of, what am I going to say next? You ever have that happen? Or you've got this inner monologue in your head, and it's like, I wonder what I'm going to say when they're done talking. This is not good. And I learned this a couple of years ago because I had to have a few very important conversations with my wife. So guys, listen up. This one's for free. Okay. I would get home and, we'd be talking about our days. And my wife would usually be making dinner at the time. And sometimes she'd be telling me what was going on in her day while I was browsing Facebook on my phone. Oh, listen to the judgment in this room right now. Hey, judge not lest you be judged, okay? Here's the thing. Man, the air just got sucked out of the room by all the women in here. Okay, here's the thing. It was so innocent. I thought I was listening because I could tell that she was, talking. And I was kind of following the themes, but I greatly overestimated my ability to multitask. And we would find that out when she asked me some kind of like a comprehension question, and I would fail miserably. And she would be very frustrated, as she should have been. That was not a very loving thing to do. And everyone in here knows that. So I had to learn. Can't do that. I need to just be present in the moment with her when she's talking to me. But like, it's so obvious to everyone in this room that I shouldn't have done that, right? But yet, when we talk to people about philosophical, difficult moral issues, we think it's fine to have this inner voice going on in our heads. No, you gotta turn that voice off and just be present in the moment with this person that you're talking to. And even if that means that you've got to take a moment after they're done and process, that's fine. It's great because it shows them that you're taking them seriously. People aren't used to that. Pro-life people could change that paradigm, though. And the last idea is to find genuine common ground when possible. Pro-choice people are going to say things that you agree with, and you need to point that out. They don't expect that. They expect you to, it's like black or white. They expect there's going to be no common ground at all. But they're going to say all kinds of things that I talk to pro-choice people all the time, and they think a lot of times that abortion, late-term abortions are wrong. Maybe they should even be illegal. They think sex-selection abortions are wrong. They think abortion should happen less often. I agree with those things. It's our job to point that out. Some of those powerful words you can tell a pro-choice person is, ooh, I like what you said. I agree with you. And then you talk about the thing that you disagree on. And it shows them that you're not polar opposites. Maybe you're a reasonable human being and we can have a very interesting conversation. And the last thing your pastor asked me to talk about is maybe the most common pro-choice argument, which is that, well, it's a woman's body. She should be able to do whatever she wants with anything inside of her body. This is the most complicated part of the abortion debate, and he asked me to talk about this in a couple of minutes. Okay, I have literally an hour-long lecture on this idea, and so I'm not going to do it justice in a few minutes, but I'm almost out of time, so I'm going to give you a couple of ideas. But I really encourage you to get our course and take this part of the pro-life, the abortion debate seriously, because if you can't respond to this well, you will not change very many pro-choice minds. You just can't. This is one of the most important things going on for pro-choice people, is they feel like even if it's a person, even if it is a valuable human being made in God's image, she should still have the right to an abortion because it's in her body, because it would be a government overreach to restrict what women can do with their bodies. A couple of quick ideas. If that's true, there should be no restrictions on abortion. If a woman should be able to do whatever she wants with anything inside of her body, which is usually how the argument is made, then there should be no restrictions on abortion. Like, most pro-choice people don't think that third trimester abortions should be legal. But if the way they justify their pro-choice worldview is, hey, she can do whatever she wants with anything inside of her body, where's the baby in the third trimester? It's still in her body. So she can do whatever she wants with anything inside of her body. They can't say that we need restrictions on late-term abortion. They have to choose. They have to say either all abortions are fine and keep their bodily rights argument, or they have to have the much more reasonable view that at least late-term abortions are not okay. And we want to show them they have to choose between two things so that they can have a consistent worldview. Also, we talk about thalidomide sometimes. Thalidomide is an anti-cancer drug that was given to women mainly in England in the late 50s and early 60s to help with severe morning sickness. And it's a very tragic story in modern medicine because what the medical community did not know for several years is that if you give a pregnant woman thalidomide, her baby will either die or be born with severe birth defects, like without arms and or legs. We just didn't know. It wasn't the mother's fault. Their doctor gave it to them. It just took a while for people to figure out there's a cause and effect relationship between these two things. But we'll ask someone, if they say, hey, a woman can do whatever she wants with anything inside of her body, why would it be wrong for a woman to take thalidomide then while she's pregnant? Like, people just instinctively want to say, that's not okay. Why? Why in the world would it be wrong for her to take thalidomide if she's pregnant, if she can do whatever she wants with anything inside of her body? We have a lot more ideas on what things you can say to pro-choice people, but I'll close with that. If you want to read some articles from us on this issue, you can go to our website, equalrightsinstitute.com/bodily rights. equalrightsinstitute.com/bodily rights. We've got all of our bodily rights material is just kind of linked right there. And you should also work with the Denmark Right to Life on that. Let me close. Brothers and sisters in Christ, I do not envy you for what it's like to stay true to your moral and religious beliefs in a country like Denmark that is so pro-choice. I want to encourage you to not waver, as the Bible never promises a life of ease, nor does it promise that people will always like what we have to say. However, we have hope, first and foremost in Christ. But secondly, I want to quickly give you two other reasons for hope, specifically as regards to the abortion issue in Denmark. First, the pro-life movement is becoming more effective. This is something that I'm seeing in the States. When I speak at the Students for Life conference in D.C., there's usually 2,500 students in the room, and they're smart, and they're passionate, and they're learning from what has worked in the past couple of generations, and they're also learning what has not been working, and how to modify our strategies for the modern context. You should have a lot of hope just because that is true. And I see that in the young leadership of Denmark Right to Life. The young leadership here is trying to figure out how do we become more effective. And that's why we're trying to help them. And we're so excited to be helping them because there's so much good that can be done in Denmark. And the last thing I'll tell you is that groups like Denmark Right to Life, they're training up to have an even bigger cultural impact in this country. I'm so encouraged by them. They're not timid or depressed about their situation. They are hopeful. I was talking to Alnita the first time, and I just told her, like, I feel so much sympathy for you. You have so many hard things. Only like 5% of you are pro-life. And she was like, oh, it's okay. They're not going to see us coming. They don't think we exist. So we're getting trained up, and we're going to do awesome things for God. How awesome is that? You have heroes here at Denmark Right to Life, and that should give you hope. Because the people of Denmark are not expecting to communicate with loving, gracious, and smart ambassadors for Christ and the unborn. Thank you. God bless you.